It's 5:30. I'm Nora Flaherty, and you are listening to MPBN Radio. Ahead on Maine Things Considered this evening, Republican Governor Paula Page looks to reshape Maine's energy policy, and a new bill aims to make it harder to financially exploit the elderly. We'll have those stories in your Maine newscast just ahead, but first, national and world news from NPR. This is Maine Things Considered on MPBN Radio. I'm Nora Flaherty. Just 2 days after his re-election, Governor LePage told reporters he has two big items on his agenda for this legislative session, tax reform and energy policy. He wasn't kidding about either. LePage has been consistently promoting his tax reform plan, and just this week, the governor introduced four more pieces of legislation aimed at reshaping the state's energy policy. The governor has his eye on lowering costs. Mal Leary has more.
Energy policy can be an incredibly complicated endeavor. But State Energy Office Director Patrick Woodcock says the goal is pretty simple.
The actual policy that we should be looking for in our state is lower pollution, lower cost. Any type of technology that can deliver those results should be promoted.
And that, Woodcock says, includes doing away with what's called the Renewable Portfolio Standard, a provision in current law that requires electricity providers to demonstrate that a certain percentage of their supply comes from renewable sources. But on this and other proposals, the administration faces vocal opposition. Dylan Voorhees of the Natural Resources Council of Maine says elimination of the renewable portfolio standard is extreme and ill-advised.
This bill takes a wrecking ball to our clean energy policies that have been thoughtfully established in a bipartisan manner over the last decade.
Voorhees says that requiring part of the energy used by Mainers come from renewable sources, including wind and solar, is crucial to moving the state away from its dependence on fossil fuels, which cause pollution and are subject to serious fluctuations in cost. Representative Mark Dion, a Democrat from Portland, co-chairs the Energy Utilities and Technology Committee, and he says he made a pledge to the business community at the start of the session.
We need to be predictable and consistent, and we can't turn the ship on a dime. This would, in fact, do just that, and I think it would put a lot of business initiatives and potential and existing investments in jeopardy.
But while that proposal faces clear opposition, another part of the governor's plan may garner more support. It would allow the state regulators to select a firm to act as an agent for very small solar providers. Dion says there are other similar measures before his committee that are aimed at this sector of the energy landscape.
Distributed generation that's aggregated is techno-speak for solar farms or a community solar initiative. I think that's the most reachable application of that concept.
Several other energy initiatives from the governor have been tried before and did not garner legislative support. Among them, his proposal to use revenue from the sale of wood from public lands to fund low-income energy efficiency programs is not expected to get much traction. The governor has also proposed legislation aimed at helping large users of natural gas to obtain long-term contracts for lower-cost fuel. NRCM's Dylan Voorhees doesn't like that proposal either.
Providing a backstop or a loan guarantee to an individual business, whether it's one or two, probably doesn't meet that test of whether it's broadly beneficial to ratepayers.
Another measure from the administration would take any payments to Maine from the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative Trust and direct them to businesses rather than to energy efficiency programs, which State Energy Office Director Woodcock says is a better way to make the most of that money.
Currently, all the money is going to Efficiency Maine Trust for energy efficiency projects. And the governor's policy is saying, let's return this to the businesses, allow them to make the decisions what makes sense for their business.
Not surprisingly, NRCM's Dylan Voorhees doesn't like that idea either. He says efficiency programs provide a bigger return to businesses than would simply directing cash to go to their bottom line. He says studies have shown a $5 return for every dollar invested in efficiency. Representative Dion says while some of the governor's proposals deserve discussion, He doubts they can all be considered by the time the session ends next month, and that means some may be carried over to next January. For MPBN News, I'm Mal Leary.
The need to toughen up Maine laws that protect senior citizens against financial exploitation is one thing on which Democrats and Republicans in Augusta can agree. According to a recent report, an estimated 33,000 elderly Mainers will be abused or financially exploited this year. A.J. Higgins reports on a measure aimed at addressing the issue.
While the state has made some progress on raising awareness about the potential for physical abuse of elders by caretakers or family members, Republican Senator David Burns says the threat of financial abuse also needs attention.
This bill addresses another very important matter by assuring that better responses and outcomes when criminals victimize senior citizens personally or financially.
Burns is co-sponsoring legislation, along with Democratic House Speaker Mark Eaves, that draws on the findings of a task force on financial exploitation of the elderly, convened by Maine Attorney General Janet Mills. The study found that reported abuse and exploitation cases to authorities tend to get lost in the heavy caseloads facing county prosecutors, and that investigators too often see these incidents as civil rather than criminal offenses. Burns says that by passing the beefed-up elder financial exploitation law, the legislature will send a strong message to the criminal justice system.
If this is taken on as a priority, that will filter down through the criminal justice and the court system, and it will be seen as a priority, and we'll devote more resources to it.
The bill provides about $400,000 over 2 years to pay for one detective and an assistant attorney general to investigate elder abuse cases. It would also revise existing state law to include financial exploitation within the definition of abuse. Maine Attorney General Janet Mills says the new positions would provide an additional resource for county prosecutors burdened with rising caseloads.
Ranging from everything from OUIs and disorderly conduct to fishing without a license and manslaughter and arson. So to drop that kind of a case on an assistant DA with that kind of caseload is pretty unfair, and you can understand why they go, oh, please, do I have to?
The legislature's Judiciary Committee is expected to review the bill later this month. For MPBN News, I'm A.J. Higgins.
Finally today, in its latest edition, the foodie magazine Bon Appetit describes Portland, Maine, as the new Portland, meaning that Maine's biggest city could now be on equal footing with its much bigger, ultra-hip namesake on the West Coast. Despite its small size, the article reads, Portland is growing its food scene at breakneck pace, citing the proliferation of high-end restaurants, coffee bars, food trucks, and craft breweries. While some may celebrate this trend toward trendiness, others are wondering if Portland has become perhaps too hip for its own good, and they're looking for other, less gentrified communities. Tom Porter has more.
In this industrial zone in Portland's East Bayside neighborhood is a 16,000-square-foot former warehouse that leases workspace to a variety of artists. Rents are relatively inexpensive, between $150 and $800 a month.
The mission of it is to create a sustainable workspace for artists in the Portland Peninsula that we can all guarantee will be around for hopefully a long, long time.
Kate Anker heads the art collective called Running with Scissors, which took over this building last year. Anker, who's originally from Minnesota, says the project has attracted nearly 60 artists, many of them priced out of their downtown studios by Portland's residential property boom. That boom is being fueled in part by reputation. Portland last year was voted as one of the 9 cities that's, quote, getting it right by Time magazine. Another feather in the cap of a small city, now recognized nationally for its food, its livability, and its artistic and cultural scene, among other things.
We have crossed some invisible line and become special.
Business consultant and commentator Perry Newman, a longtime Portland resident, describes the changing nature of his home city in a recent op-ed in the Falmouth Forecaster.
I think it's the recent proliferation of a number of very special places where people can no longer simply have a meal, have a coffee, have a conversation. We have to be doing it almost in character. And that seems to have happened with increasing frequency and is a trend that I think is accelerating.
Think high prices, small portions. But Newman, who admits to being a bit of a curmudgeon at times, says the issue goes beyond food. He's concerned that Portland has become so, quote-unquote, cool that it's lost sight of the authentic, unpretentious charm that made it such an appealing city in the first place. He says he first became aware of this trend about 8 years ago when he visited the newly opened Whole Foods in Bayside.
And I saw an entire cohort of people that I had never seen before. And I thought to myself, who are these people? And I came home and mentioned it to my wife, and she said, you're just getting old. And that may be part of it. But I also think there has been an influx of new people bringing with them new ideas and trends that don't originate here.
Some have dubbed Maine's largest city the New Portland, a reference to the larger uber-hip Portland that sits on the other side of the country.
No, it's definitely not the New Portland. It's actually the first one.
Jennifer Hutchins is executive director of Creative Portland, a non-profit that seeks to sustain and grow the city's cultural and artistic economy. She's sitting at a table sipping an iced tea at the Tandem Coffee and Bakery in Portland's West End, a place which typifies the city's hipster image. Retro 80s pop, on vinyl of course, provides the soundtrack. Airy and spacious, set in a restored gas station, the place opened last year, selling locally roasted coffee and what the foodie journal Bon Appetit describes as some of the most innovative baked goods this country has seen in years.
People are just finally waking up to the fact that what we have here is a great thing. We're not doing anything new. We're just being ourselves, and more people are coming and enjoying it.
Hutchins admits that Portland does face a challenge in preserving its hipster status as the city's increasing appeal drives up the cost of living and threatens to drive out the people who made it hip in the first place.
Yeah, well, that's a pretty classic scenario, isn't it? It's happened all over the country where the actually authentically interesting places get discovered. And it's, unfortunately, it's a natural progression.
And it's that natural progression that has prompted some young artists and entrepreneurs to relocate up Route 1 to the mid-coast, or to other more affordable communities down the turnpike from Portland, among them Greg Mitchell.
There's a lot of room to grow here.
Mitchell and his business partner Chad Conley are chefs who have worked at top restaurants in New York City and Portland. They now run the Palace Diner in downtown Biddeford, which first opened its doors in 1927.
We were trying to open a restaurant in Portland, and we had been looking for restaurant spaces and kind of seeing what was available in the market. Weren't finding a lot, and what we were finding was pricey.
So they expanded their search and landed in Biddeford, a one-time booming mill town 20 miles to the south that fell on hard times and is now undergoing something of a downtown resurgence. They bought the diner last year, and they don't regret it.
There's a lot of support in the community, and you see the impact that you're making.
A few minutes' walk from the diner is the Elements Bookstore and Coffee Shop, part of a building complex that includes the Engine Arts Centre, a non-profit that aims to grow Biddeford's creative economy by organising exhibits and community art projects.
It has incredibly good bones. You know, it's a walkable community. The architecture is spectacular.
Sipping a coffee before heading to work next door is Engine's executive director, Tammy Ackerman, who's originally from South Dakota. She sings the praises of Biddeford's imposing mill district and its huge empty industrial spaces that are now starting to be repurposed for new commercial ventures. Ackerman says key to Biddeford's hipster appeal is its blue-collar authenticity.
And I think that authenticity piece is what is at risk when we're talking about the dirty G word, you know, the gentrification word.
So far, Ackerman says Biddeford has avoided the kind of gentrification that she believes has overtaken much of Portland. So, which community is the hippest? Well, that all depends on what you mean by hip. For MPBN News, I'm Tom Porter.
Checking in on the weather, clear tonight with some frost in the mountains and lows in the high 20s to low 40s, coolest in the mountains with mildest temperatures along the shore. And tomorrow, sunny with temperatures in the upper 60s to low 70s, cooler along the coast. That's Main Things Considered for tonight. Thanks today to Ed Morin, Patty White, and Andrew Catalina. I'm Nora Flaherty.